This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, we've had at least 2,000 migrants rescued in the past few days, 3,400 last weekend. So these migrants are continuing to come, many from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan. But there's growing pressure on where to put these migrants.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome with an update on migrant rescues on the Mediterranean. We'll have details coming up. Also, the European Union Parliament expresses what it calls serious concerns about growing violence against demonstrators in Zimbabwe. There are an estimated 60 million refugees around the world, far more than can be effectively resettled in the U.S., Europe, or elsewhere. And Libya resumes oil exports. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the European Union Parliament is expressing what it calls serious concerns about growing violence against demonstrators in Zimbabwe. These include informal traders, unemployed young people, and professionals. They've been protesting a faltering economy that's brought very high unemployment and a cash crisis. In addition, the EU Parliament is calling on Zimbabwe authorities to immediately and unconditionally release all political prisoners. It's also condemned President Robert Mugabe's recent criticism of the judiciary. Zimbabwe security forces have been battling anti-government protesters for months. One protest leader has fled to the United States. But the leader of another major group, Tajamuka, which means "we are agitated," held a press conference today. It came just 2 days after 31-year-old Promise Umkhonanzi was released from a month in prison. Reporter Kudzai Svenashi talked with VOA's David Arnold about what the protest leader had to say to supporters. Tomorrow, they plan to join a demonstration by a coalition of anti-government political parties called the National Electoral Reforms Agenda.
The main message was calling for the immediate release of political prisoners, which is basically an echo of what the EU has been calling from the Zimbabwean government.
How many political prisoners are there in jail now in Zimbabwe?
It's hard to keep count, but I can safely say over 20.
Tell us about Mr. Mkhwanazi. He was one of those political prisoners who was recently released.
He was arrested and charged with public violence and then taken to Chikurubi Maximum Prison along with other colleagues who were arrested during the protest.
Can you list for us some of the reforms they are demanding?
They include having diaspora and Zimbabweans based in the diaspora to be able to vote, voter registration be made available to all political parties, people that are illiterate be allowed to vote in privacy. Oh yeah, they touched on one note. He also fired shots at international bodies that have been meddling in politics, saying that the British, who recently endorsed the Vice President Mnangagwa to take the presidency when President Robert Mugabe exits, and also the ones that have been bankrolling the bond notes that are coming. He specifically said international bodies should not jump the gun. They should keep a distance. They have to be chosen by Zimbabweans.
Are there any concerns about police trying to stop those demonstrations?
He touched on police, but not in that context. He said the police has been disobeying the law and expecting everyone to respect the law, as they've breached the Constitution countless times, constitutional demonstrations that have been happening.
The government's proposal of a one-month ban on protests has not been approved by the court.
It was thrown out, but there is another effort by a police head who's responsible for Harare. So that one specifically bans protests within the central business district.
That sounds like a third proposal by police to prevent demonstrations. The first one was for 1 or 2 weeks, was thrown out of court, and the second one was for 1 month, and now the local police chief is asking for one just for the central business district. Do you have any idea how many people are planning to attend and what organizations are supporting it?
For now, I can say NERA has 10 political parties, which include some of the biggest opposition parties, MDC, and a lot more. And also Tajamuka, is behind it. Pastor Ivan's movement has been on the low down, but I'm almost certain that he will support it. To really say how many people participate, it's usually difficult. Because what happens on the eve of these demonstrations, there's usually heavy police presence on the streets, which goes a long way in intimidating people from participating. And as a result, probably a few staunch activists are coming up to protest.
That was reporter Kudzai Svenavashi from Harare. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold. Libya has resumed oil exports. It's the first time it's done so since military forces under the command of General Khalifa Haftar recaptured oil installations west of Benghazi this past week. Haftar is loyal to the parliament in Tobruk, not the government of National Accord in Tripoli. A Maltese-flagged oil tanker bound for China reportedly has left the Libyan oil port of Ras Lanuf. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Fayez Sarraj, who heads Libya's UN-brokered National Unity government, has been meeting in Cairo with the head of the Tobruk-based parliament, Akila Saleh, according to Arab and Egyptian media. The men reportedly have been trying to cobble together an agreement over a new government acceptable to rival political factions. Parliament Speaker Saleh has repeatedly insisted on the need for a limited-sized government acceptable to all parties. The Tobruk-based parliament refused to approve a unity government composed of 30 ministers earlier this year. Ramzi Ramia, a Libyan military analyst, told Arab media that the talks were centered on building a tightly knit government of under a dozen people.
He
says that Saleh and Sarraj were attempting to put together a government with a three-member defense council, including Army Commander General Khalifa Haftar, and a three-member presidential council, along with representatives of Prime Minister Sarraj and outgoing interim Prime Minister Abdullah Thani. At the same time, General Haftar, who heads the Libyan army under the auspices of the Tobruk-based parliament, was promoted to the rank of field marshal by Parliament Speaker Saleh. It is not clear if the move would affect the talks. The move came just days after Haftar's forces captured Libya's strategic oil export installations of Ras Lanuf, Sidra, Zweitina, and Brega west of Benghazi. Libya also made its first oil export shipment in recent days, according to the Arab daily Al-Hayat, after a Maltese-flagged oil tanker left the port of Zweitina with a cargo bound for China. U.S.-Libya envoy Jonathan Weiner called the shipment a promising development in a tweet, saying well-placed Libyans say the military has withdrawn from the oil terminals, leaving them in the hands of the country's national oil company. The UN Special Envoy for Libya, Martin Kobler, told journalists in Misrata late Thursday that he considered the army presence in the oil installations a problem.
It is very important to have the Libyan National Army out of the oil fields and out of the oil terminals. The oil belongs to all Libyans. And it's the National Oil Company who has the management of the oil in this country.
Kobler added that he welcomed the statement of the head of the National Oil Company, Mustafa Sanallah, that he was under the authority of the Presidency Council.
It is good to lift the oil exports here in Libya. However, it is very important to export the oil legally, and the profits are going to the central bank.
In a related development, Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry said in a statement from New York, where he is attending the opening session of the UN General Assembly, that Egypt supports the legitimacy and actions of the Libyan army to maintain security in the country. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. While rescue ships remained busy this week as migrants continue to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa to Europe, there's only a few weeks of good weather left before the crossing becomes even more dangerous. Italian authorities are investigating a possible case of a migrant selling a kidney to raise money for his journey to Europe. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following migrant developments. From Rome, she first gave VOA's Joe DiCapua an update on rescue efforts.
Well, we've had at least 2,000 migrants rescued in the past few days, 3,400 last weekend. So these migrants are continuing to come, many from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan. But there's growing pressure on where to put these migrants. We now have 800 in the centre up in Ventimiglia on the French border, run by the Red Cross. And the Red Cross says that centre alone is designed for 350 migrants. So that gives you some idea of the sort of pressure in Italy. A few days ago, we also saw some cry for help in Milan, where they had been inundated. We've also got around 300 still in Lake Como. And I understand the Red Cross is looking at trying to help manage the migrants there and get them off the streets and ensure that they have a bed and food in that particular area.
We're hearing the same thing from Paris, where authorities are going around. I think they're trying to round up about 1,500 migrants who've been living on the city streets there. Now, you had mentioned Milan, and there's a disturbing story coming out of there. As you know, there have been rumors for months about migrants possibly selling their organs to raise money to get to Europe to pay the smugglers. What have you heard about what happened in Milan?
Well, a Sudanese man showed up at a Milan hospital, and doctors were very concerned because his left kidney was no longer there, and there were signs of an operation. He claimed that he had been drugged in Libya. It was against his will. The organ was removed without his permission. But when police went to try and interview him and get to the bottom of what happened, the migrant couldn't be found. Italian authorities immediately notified other hospitals in Milan just to try and find out if this is a common issue with the migrants who are showing up on the streets of Milan. And so far, we haven't had any other incidences there. But a Sicilian prosecutor, Maurizio Scalia, told Italian radio this week that migrants who cannot pay for their voyage are being forced to have their organs removed and sold on the black market, in particular in Libya. And he says they're being sold on the black market for around $15,000. So that's a very worrying sign. As I said, we haven't got a lot of evidence yet to support that. But most migrants are also unwilling to share that information. And they're very concerned because they may have family members who are still making the journey, who may still be trapped in Libya and other countries, so they don't want to draw attention to this kind of issue.
Now, if that price is right, about $15,000, from what I gather, that might be enough to smuggle an entire family across the Mediterranean.
I'm not absolutely sure of what the current rate is, but it's certainly several thousand dollars for one person. So $15,000 could be for a whole family. And as we know, we're seeing individuals traveling on their own. We're seeing unaccompanied minors. And whatever age they are, they all are incredibly vulnerable. They all seem to be very traumatized by their experience and very concerned about the violence that they suffer.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. While there are an estimated 60 million refugees around the world, far more than can be effectively resettled in the U.S., Europe, or elsewhere, and those who do manage to begin new lives abroad often face daunting challenges. For the second part of our series about African refugees, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Melanie Nezer, chairwoman of the Refugee Council USA, which helps resettle refugees in the United States.
I wish we could do that for more people. There are a very limited number of spots for African refugees to be resettled. Most African refugees who are resettled do go to the U.S. We are the largest resettlement destination for African refugees from around the continent. But basically, there are people from countries around Africa who have been in refugee camps for years, if not generations, mainly in Kenya, but also in Ethiopia and other places, refugees from Somalia in particular, but also from Sudan. There are Congolese refugees who are in Uganda, and also Sudanese refugees in Chad. So the importance of resettlement for people who really don't have any other options or have been really stuck for a long time is quite important.
And what do you actually do to lubricate their satisfying exit?
We don't have any control over who gets chosen. That is between the UN Refugee Agency and the U.S. government. We can help do the paperwork. We get all the biographical information. Mm-hmm. The U.S. government does all the security clearances and screenings, mm-hmm. but we can help get the information to start that process. But once you are chosen, once the U.S. decides to take you, because UNHCR has decided that you need to go someplace, the process starts. Now, the process can take several years. So we get involved once the U.S. has decided, yes, we're going to take this person or this family. We do the interviews. We do some cultural orientation.
What does that involve?
Just some introduction to the U.S., life in the U.S., what to expect. It's a very different place to live. You know, if you are already an English speaker, you're going to have an easier time. If you're from an urban environment, you have probably already, you know, used a modern bathroom, but some people may have never even had that experience. So we explain how that works. We talk about kind of really critical things like the rights of women and that women can walk around basically wearing whatever they want in the U.S., you know, things to expect, the certain norms that we have about, you know, how you have to treat your children, the you know, things that are illegal, we don't corporal punishment, things like that. So certainly it's not enough time, but that's something that we do as part of the process.
Do you identify communities here that want to accept them?
That's later in the process. Once someone is about ready to travel, this happens pretty quickly. If you have family in the U.S., you will most likely be resettled where your family is because it would make no sense not to do that. If you don't, you really have no say in the process. I mean, you could be Congolese and you could end up in, in Idaho. You know, and plus you've had some trauma in your life or you haven't had access to education, you know, or your kids have been out of school and you haven't been able to work for a while. So it's a lot of adjustment.
I know that very often refugees come to live in areas or neighborhoods where people from their own countries or areas also live.
You know, all refugee groups form communities. People like to go where they can join people that have been through their experience and understand their culture. Right. I mean, if you're an African refugee and you want to open up a restaurant, you want to be around people that are going to, you know, be your first customers. And you want to be someplace where you have social ties mm-hmm. and you can, you know, call somebody for a job or to help you get an apartment or something. So
do you help with those kind of contacts?
We do. I mean, most of the staff of resettlement agencies are also refugees from all over the world. And for example, our affiliate in Columbus, it's run by former refugees from the Soviet Union, you know, Jewish women who have started this resettlement agency. And they have Iraqi and Bhutanese and Burmese and Hmong employees, Somalis, who, you know, are the first people that work with the refugees when they come here. And they're all colleagues and they work together on this mission. Refugees are just people, you know, and they are just you or me. I come from a Jewish family. I have refugees in my family. Anybody can be a refugee if things break the wrong way.
That was Melanie Nezer, chairwoman of the Refugee Council USA. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. In Liberia, young people suffering from mental health issues will receive additional and tailored support thanks to a new two-year project. It's a collaborative effort between the Atlanta, Georgia-based Carter Center and the UBS Optimus Foundation, which provides grants for projects supporting vulnerable children. They've partnered to train 130 health and education professionals with skills to identify and treat the mental health needs of youth. Among those needing assistance are more than 3,600 Liberian children affected by last year's outbreak of Ebola. Thousands were orphaned and confined in isolation units or left at home to watch loved ones suffer. Janice Cooper is the country lead for the Carter Center's Liberia Mental Health Initiative. She spoke with me about the urgency behind the effort to support these young people.
I think that they're extremely serious because we have a history of civil conflict and then most recently, of course, a history of Ebola. And young people have, especially adolescents and young adults, have better prospects because there's a high unemployment rate among young people. And I think in addition, we struggle with access to health and mental health care for children and adolescents, as well as poor access to education. So all of these things pose a problem for us.
What types of mental illnesses do you all see young people suffering from there?
We see children with conduct problems. We see children who are withdrawn, and some of them who adolescents who have depression. We see the whole gamut of child mental health needs. There's a lot of trauma in our society, and there are a lot of children who have experienced abuse and as a result also exhibit signs of trauma.
How has the Ebola crisis affected children psychologically?
Ebola was disturbing for everybody in the country, but for children in particular, to try and make sense of an outbreak that really does not allow social contact. So in addition to having approximately between 9 and 10,000 children who were orphaned, either losing one or both parents, there are child survivors of Ebola as well. And for many children, they lost a lot of school time. That also had an impact on issues around adolescent pregnancy. Many of these children were unsupervised for large stretches of time during the day because schools had been closed.
You all are now providing additional tailored mental health services there for young people. What are these services?
We're training nurses and physician assistants to provide a range of mental health services in the schools. We also have school-based clinics that have been established to integrate health and mental health at the school level. We have child and adolescent mental health clinicians that are doing a range of psychosocial as well as mental health services directly to children and to their families.
How important are these services for young people, and how will these services impact them for the future?
I think that the services are vital because for many children, we have limited access to primary education. And so if they have that access to education and they are still troubled and they can't take advantage of that, then that's a double blow. For some children, the ability to function really is dependent on them being able to get services and support through the mental health clinicians and through the services that we provide. Essentially, many children have mental health issues that impact their ability to learn. So if we can support teachers in the classroom to identify those kids early and help them to do better classroom management so those kids can keep up, those are all important things in their growth and development.
Janice Cooper is the country lead for the Carter Center's Liberia Mental Health Initiative. She spoke with me from Monrovia. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.